You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey y'all, spooky season is here, and if you're looking for a show to whet your appetite for a little haunted history, then I'd like to invite you to check out Southern Gothic, a chart-topping history podcast that explores some of the most infamous legends, folklore, ghost stories, and hauntings of the American South. We've covered all sorts of stuff from the Bell Witch of Tennessee to the disappearance of the Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley. Not to mention our deep dives into the local lore of some of America's oldest and most haunted cities, like New Orleans, Charleston, and St. Augustine. So, if you're ready for a little good old-fashioned Halloween storytelling with a commitment to quality historical research, then be sure to check out Southern Gothic today. It's available now on all your favorite podcast apps.
Monster House presents.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Hey there. What follows is an audio version of an interview originally recorded as part of our Monster Talk live streaming series that Karen and I hosted during 2020. As of this posting, we're not currently doing those live shows, but they are archived on YouTube. You can check the show notes for a link to this particular episode. And the live format's definitely something we're going to try to get back to in the future. These episodes do not get the normal editing treatment of a traditional Monster Talk, and because of the variety of issues that happen during live recordings, the audio quality may be wildly varied, and you should assume there will be some not-safe-for-work content, so I'm posting all of these as explicit just in case. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting Monster Talk. Your contributions at patreon.com/monstertalk and your positive reviews on the podcasting platforms and applications that you use to listen help us reach new listeners and spread the important message that monsters can be a great tool to learn critical thinking. We need critical thinking now more than ever. Monster Talk is hosted by me, Blake Smith, and my co-host, Dr. Karen Stolzno. If you enjoy this show, please check out our deep catalog of fascinating interviews with experts about psychology, sociology, anthropology, folklore, religion, and more.
Monster Talk.
Well, all right.
We're so professional.
Every time. Like, I'm so surprised there's not a fire in the back going.
Like, oh, and I've got to.
Actually, right over there, there is.
So this is Monster Talk Live. I'm Blake.
And I'm Karen.
And tonight we've got with us Banachek, We'll get with you in just a second.
Where's Banachek?
You're down here somewhere. You're around here.
Okay. Behind you.
We're Monster Talk .org. Yeah, that's us. Patreon.com/Monster Talk. You can support us. But we're very excited to welcome mentalist and magician and
the world's greatest mentalist.
There you go.
This is why I love her. So yes. Thank you.
So yeah, this is really exciting. I know you know Karen already, and you've met me a couple of times. You probably don't remember that, but
TAM or where?
Well, so we met twice. Both times were at TAM. One time we were watching a talk, and I was sitting on the floor up near the front, and you came and sat down beside me, and we chatted for a minute. It doesn't really matter. And then the second time,
we weren't watching the talk. I was looking at you the whole time. Is this what you're saying?
Yeah, you were very gentle and kind and supportive, and I really liked that. And the other time was when Bill.
I'm not touching that.
Bill Nye. Remember when Bill Nye came and did like some consulting on the Million Dollar Challenge?
Oh yeah, we talked about the vortex. And stuff
yeah,
like
yeah.
That.
Yeah. So yeah, yeah. I was one of the people in there for that, which I was really excited. Because Bill Nye said I was doing a good job, so I've been
So we've been doing these shows, just regular podcasts for the past 10 years, but just during the pandemic, we've had a lot of requests for something more interactive. So we do have, I guess we've got people popping on and saying, hello, yes, we've got a bunch of people here already.
This is possible.
Saying hi.
I need to figure out how to do two windows on this. I moved to a new computer today. So, there they are. Okay, cool. I'm seeing the chat now.
Yeah, so we've got some people in the chat room there. Yeah. But thank you very much for...
So you'll have to let me know what they ask, what they
say.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, when the questions come through, but we've got some of our own questions too. So we've had, in advertising this show, we've had a lot of people make jokes about a television show called Banachek. Blake, you've watched it before, haven't you?
Yeah, because you had mentioned it, I actually tracked it down and got all the episodes on DVD and watched them.
Not a lot. I think it was like two seasons.
It was exactly
mistaken.
Two seasons. Yeah. So, are you still a fan of the show?
Why would I not be? Yes.
I don't know. No, it's really good. I was so pleasantly surprised when I watched the first episode. It's like everyone's a locked door mystery. They're good.
Yeah. So here's the thing, right? My actual born name was Stephen Shaw, right? I actually went by Steve Martin for a little while before Steve Martin was famous over in the UK, because my stepfather's name was Martin. Different story. But I was doing a lot of corporate gigs under the name Steve Shaw, and I didn't even go by Steven. It was just Steve Shaw. And I did a show one time, and the guy came out. And he says, I've seen him on CNN Live. He's on the Today Show. He's done this. He's done that. Please welcome Steve. What was the last name again? I was like, great. So that same week, I had another corporate gig. I had a few corporate gigs that week. And I said, hey, the last guy forgot my last name. And said, well, I want to do my own introduction. You know, and I was young. I was like too shy to say, this is my introduction. Do it the way it is. And I didn't have it already on a tape or anything like that. Second guy goes, yeah, I got it. Steve Shaw. No problem. Got it. I've seen him do this. I've seen him do that. And he's been on this TV show. He's been in Psychology Today. Please welcome Steve. What was the last name again? Happened twice. It happened three times in a row, even on that third one, even though I was real emphasis on the name, right? And I thought, why is this happening? So I started looking at, being a mentalist, I look at things from sort of a psychological point of view. I was like, why is this happening? Then I realized Steve and Shaw are very common names. So people don't think that they have to think about it. They just think, oh, yeah, I've got it. No, easy. It's easy. And then the other thing, there's no real hard syllables there. And I wanted something sort of a mnemonic because I was working for all these CEOs, these older guys, and I wanted something that they would help them remember the name. So there was a TV show with George Pappard in it, and it was called Banachek. Now, that was Banachek, spelt the Polish way.
Right.
And I thought, I loved that show. It was sort of a mystery. Every episode was a mystery. It was an insurance salesman. And like a statue would be put into a truck, and then it's locked. And then when it gets there, it's disappeared. Where did it go? You know, that kind of thing. And it would be almost very magical, the explanation in a way. So I loved the show. And I thought these old guys would remember the show as well, because George Pappard, a well-known actor. And they did. And they never forgot the name. And if you hadn't seen the show, you had to ask me, you had to say, how do you pronounce it? Because I put a C-H-E-K because I didn't want like bounce a check with the extra C in it, or Banasek, because that's how Americans would say it. So I made it so it's basically said the way that
you tried to make it idiot proof, right? Yeah.
I tried. It does not always work. Like if I work over in like Finland or something, for some reason, when I do a TV show, it comes out, it's Dave Banachek. I'm like, where did they even get Dave from? I have no clue. I've done research. There was a construction company, which I basically stole the website from because they hadn't done anything with it for like 3 years. And that was before you could actually pay to let you know when it was up or put it on auto payments, right? And so I was able to get that. There's a greyhound by the name of Vanishek. There's a horse by the name of Vanishek. And there was a band by the name of Vanishek, spelled the way that I spell it. Other than that, there was nothing. Now there's a few other Vanishek's around. So I don't know if people are naming their kids after me or if there's something I should know. I don't know. I mean, kids, I have kids out there I don't know about. Who knows, you know?
No, but I really appreciate it because it turned out to be extremely entertaining to watch those shows. And
I've got to watch them still.
Yeah,
but
you do.
I've heard a lot about them.
Yeah, really, a lot of fun. A lot of fun. So
they're good.
So just got a brief question. You're in Las Vegas at the moment. And I'm just wondering, what's Las Vegas like during this quarantine, this lockdown? What's the strip look like?
Yeah, it's very surreal, right? Because you're used to having all these lights, you're used to having traffic, you're used to having people, and you go down there, and entire casinos are boarded up. You know how, like in Katrina, you saw buildings boarded up, right? They're doing that to some of the casinos because I guess they don't want people breaking in, even though they've got security and like even on the streets, the like half of the road is blocked off, so you could only go down one side or the other. So quite a few people from Las Vegas are getting out on their bikes and walking down there at night, not around other people, but it's very surreal to go down there and see absolutely nothing. We'll probably never see it that way again.
Interestingly, though, we can tie George Peppard and boarded up Las Vegas together in the movie Damnation Alley. I don't know if you are familiar with that, but he's leading a little team of post-apocalyptic soldiers to the promised land or something, but they stop in Vegas and it's all boarded up and it's all shut down and it has George Peppard. So yeah, check it out, people. Yeah. Great movie. So
I'm sure we're going to go to the A-Team next, right?
Right. No. Well, that's the thing. The Banachek show, he was so suave. Oh my God. So like, you know, if you only know him from Hannibal, oh, was it Hannibal Smith, I guess, right? Is that what his name is?
Hannibal Smith, yeah.
I think so. Yeah, anyway, if you only know him from his Hannibal character on the A-Team, you've missed out on a lot of Peppard, right? There's some classic Peppard. Sorry.
Wasn't he also in Paint Your Wagon, I think, or something like that?
Well, that was Clint Eastwood and Lee Marvin, if I remember.
Lee Marvin. I get him mixed up. Every once in a while, I get him mixed with Lee Marvin.
They both have their early white hair. Yeah.
We also had a few people who thought that Banachek was the guy from To Catch a Predator.
I don't know. That's just the pose in the picture, I think. They were like,
which guy? The guy catching them?
The guy catching the predator, right?
Not the predator.
Can we clarify this, please?
The host of the show. So I went looking him up, and a little bit. And I think it was the suit and the tie and your pose and everything. So you looked a little bit like him. But yeah,
I get the Trivago man, and I get Richard Gere a lot lately.
Oh, nice. That's not a bad comparison.
I'm not going to complain.
No, that sounds like a good, that's just good. That's good.
So all your listeners right now are going, who the hell is this Banachek guy?
Who the hell is this Banachek guy?
Yeah. Okay. So, are you asking me or?
I'm not asking Karen. Karen.
Who is Banachek, Karen?
The world's greatest mentalist.
Back to that.
But a lot of our viewers are skeptics and people who've been involved in the skeptical movement. And so a lot of them know you through the whole Project Alpha story. But then we've got a lot of people who might not have heard of Project Alpha before. Could you give us just a little overview of what that was and what your participation was in that project?
Yeah, so back in the 1980s, I mean, you have to realize it was a whole different culture when it came to the paranormal, right? We look at things now and we go, oh, people believing in metal bending, people believing in putting tin foil on your head or making little pyramids and sharpening up razor blades and all these things. But you have to think back. I mean, this is a time when, you know, we had the Cold War going on. This is a time when the Soviet Union was putting out videos of their psychics being able to do these amazing things, right? It was a time when Yuri Geller first came out and said that he could actually bend metal with his mind or could change solid objects in some form, some way. And also, it was also the time when In Search Of, where the number one show was on television at the time with Leonard Nimoy, and they were in search of all these crazy claims that we didn't think were crazy back then, right? So we had what we felt was real evidence of ESP coming out of different governments, well, at least the common person thought that it was real evidence at that particular time. And Geller was making his claims. It had been studied at Stanford Research Institute, and they'd endorsed it, which isn't exactly right if you start going back and taking a look. But anyway, so I guess I should start from me sort of at the beginning a little bit with my life. I was born in England. I left when I was 9. I went to South Africa. It was while I was in South Africa that I was abandoned by my mom. I had 2 brothers, 1 year and 3 years old, pretty much raised them by myself from 9. We had an alcoholic stepfather who was there, but we barely saw him maybe on Sundays. And there was a man on radio, on Springbok radio, by the name of Uri Geller. Now, Geller, as I said, claimed that he could actually bend metal with his mind. And all the adults that I knew at that time believed Geller was genuine. So why wouldn't I believe he was genuine? There was a point in the radio program where Geller said, look, if you go get a piece of metal and you bring it to the radio, you can get it to bend as well. So I went looking, and my mama left a sewing kit. So I picked up a needle and I brought it to the radio and I concentrated on it. And I really believed I could actually do this. I mean, why wouldn't I want a superpower, right? I mean, who wouldn't want a superpower, especially considering the upbringing that I was having at the time? I wanted something beyond those, you know, bad times. And, I believed it had bent on a micro level, not a macro level, but so tiny that I could barely see it. But I believed that it actually bent. And from there, I left there, went to Australia with my biological dad, who had left when I was a year old, moved to Colorado. And then, while I was in Colorado, I picked up a book written by James the Amazing Brandy, and it was called The Magic of Uri Geller, or The Truth of Uri Geller, depending which edition you have. And the truth, as Randy put it, was that Geller was nothing more than a magician posing as a psychic. And I didn't even know there was a subcategory of magic called mentalism. But in that book, Randy taught a method for actually bending a nail, an optical way of bending a nail. And from there, I started to create other methods to bend metal objects. Now, I had never seen Geller because there wasn't TV in South Africa. There was just the radio. But I'd heard that when you watched Geller, you could actually see the metal bending. It wasn't until years later that I realized quite often when he was bending forks, he would basically just put it in a kid's hand or cover it with his hand, take his hand away, and it was bent. The keys, he used optical bends and the nails. In fact, Geller uses some of my methods now. But I started creating all these methods to bend metal. And while I was in high school, the kids were stealing all the cutlery from the cafeteria, bringing it to me. And we went to plastic silverware until I graduated. I got in trouble because I made the school bell go off early so we could get out of school early. I said I was doing it psychically, but I actually found a way to cross the wires and nobody really knew. But I wrote Randy a letter. I said, look, if you ever need a kid to try to convince scientists that this stuff is real, I'd be happy to do so. And Randy said, I didn't expect to get a letter back. He said, look, if you're ever out in New Jersey, come and visit. I had the opportunity to do it. I saved up. I went out there to go see Randy. And I was really disappointed because he didn't ask to see me do anything. Basically just got to know my personality. And I found out years later, it was so that he could actually tell the parapsychologist, if it ever was going to happen, that, hey, this kid taught himself. Can you imagine if I had taught him what he would have been able to do? I think back now, and I think that statement's not exactly 100% correct, because if Randy had taught me, he would have taught me the ways of a magician. Whereas because I was teaching myself in the moment, they didn't come off as magical looking. I didn't come off looking like a magician. I came off like just a regular kid who had these abilities, right? And then the opportunity came about. Washington University was given $500,000 by James S. McDonnell Aircraft to study psychic phenomena. And they put a gentleman in charge by the name of Peter Phillips. Now, he was a physicist at Washington U. And he put out an Associated Press article saying he was looking for kids that could bend metal with their minds. I wrote them a letter, and they accepted me. And then I got a call from Randy, actually, right after. He said, hey, there's this guy in St. Louis who at Washington University who has been given $500,000 to study psychic phenomena. I said, Randy, just think of his name. Start with a P, second name P. He said, how did you know? I said, I've already been accepted. I was going to let you know. And it was at that point that Randy told me about another kid that had already been there, who had bent some keys for them, convinced them he was real. And then that kid had called Randy as well. And I said, can I trust this kid? And he said, I don't know. And the kid's name was Mike Edwards. And Mike and I, we met each other at the airport, but actually when I arrived for the first time, we knew immediately that we were going to hit it off. Like immediately we knew we were going to hit it off. And for 4 years, we worked with a scientist. We convinced them we were genuine psychics. So there's a lot of stories that go with this. If you want them at some point, we can, you know, drop into those. And then after those 4 years, we came out and explained that everything we had performed was an illusion. And I say performed because they were basically mini performances. and that we were able to convince them that we were genuine psychics. It basically hit every major newspaper. We had a huge press conference where we revealed that this was all a hoax. And it pretty much changed the way that parapsychological research is done at that time. You see, at a very early age, even before I got in contact with Randy, I had two hypotheses of my own. And Randy had them too. And I think Mike also had these hypotheses as well. And basically, it was scientists had lamented for many, many years. There was no evidence of ESP under proper scientific controls because of lack of funding. And it was my contention had nothing to do with funding. It had to do with a bias. Their bias was always going to get in the way. In other words, they had a pro-bias. They believed in this phenomena. So rather than trying to find out if it was real, they were basically documenting what they already believed, which is not the way that you do science. You have to step outside of your own belief system. And then the other thing was that because they had PhDs, they would think they were too smart to be fooled, especially by kids. So they would not accept the outside help of somebody else like the amazing Randy, who didn't have a PhD, right? But had the expertise in magic. And that's exactly what happened. In fact, even before we went into the laboratory, Randy wrote them 11 caveats saying, don't let the kids do this. Don't let whoever you're working with, don't let them work with more than one object at a time because they can use one object to distract you from the other. Let more than one person work at the same time because they can use this distraction. And so we had this whole list of things. And when we arrived, the scientists basically showed Mike and I this list from the amazing Randy and had a good laugh about it, saying, oh, well, you know, it would be way too stringent and you wouldn't be able to perform under those conditions. And every time we performed anything, I came up with a method of doing something, I would immediately let Randy know. Randy would shoot them a letter and he would say, if you're doing something where you might be doing a test with a rotor under a bell jar, make sure they can't do this. And they never really caught on how Randy knew about the experiments. They never, ever questioned that. And even at the very end on the reveal, I got a phone call from one of the scientists asked me, well, what about this? Well, what about this? Well, what about this? Just looking for one little thing they could hold on to so they could still believe in this phenomena.
Wow.
So, yeah. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. No, yeah. Do you get I've been interested in this a long time. Do you have was Uri Geller the first one to do spoons? Like, why spoons? Why spoons? That's the thing that's been puzzling me for a while. Like, why cutlery? Why? I mean, I know obviously it's readily available, but I mean, of all the things you could do with your superpowers, why bin spoons? I
don't know either. I mean, unless you're going to go to war with forks and spoons, somebody's coming at you, it's not going to help you a whole lot, is it? So I just think that it's possible that it was keys, spoons, forks, because they're just kind of readily everyday objects that are available, right? It's like when I work with Chris Angel for all those years, we always try to make everything very generic. If it wasn't something you could just pick up and use, we wouldn't use it in a trick. It had to seem like it was real. It was there at the moment. You know, if we're going to impale Chris, where are we going to impale him? Are we going to get this weird looking sword and do it? No, what we're going to do is be walking past somebody's yard and then we impale him on the fence. So it's generic. And I think probably that's why with Geller, where it came about originally, was it was just something that was very generic. Who knows? Maybe he was at somebody's house, he picked up a fork and he started rubbing it or doing something and said he did it with his mind and it went over well. I don't know the whole story on that.
So I didn't know if it predated him or not. That's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, there were coins that got bent before that, but that was more of a feat of strength, bending coins. Bending nails would be a feat of strength. Right. The only thing that I do know that was before Geller, which was an optical bend, was the stirrer in like martinis and drinks, the plastic stirrer.
Yeah, yeah.
Something, and I think it was either in Jinx or it was in one of the magic magazines. I don't know which one. And there was bending that by just holding it up and staring at it and melting it with your eyes, not brain power, but with your eyes. So, yeah.
Neat.
Yeah.
So, I guess you have figured out, but there's more than one way to bend a fork or a spoon or a key.
Yeah.
So have you figured out what Uri Geller, his tricks, or are you just kind of replicating them in the various ways that you can, or is there one specific way that he does it?
Yeah. When I saw Geller originally, I was very disappointed. And I actually saw him at a convention when I was posing as a psychic, and I'm sitting in the front and I'm watching him do what he does. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, don't they see this? But I'm in a room full of believers. Like, it's just a room full of believers. I'm looking, I'm going, because there wasn't much technique to it. There wasn't a whole lot of technique to it. It was more misdirection, but if you're not misdirected, surely you would see it, right? Mm-hmm. His methods were very, very crude, but keep in mind, at that particular time, nobody else was doing this. So if you don't know what to look for, and if you believe in it, I hadn't seen yellow. So I started creating all these different methods for bending objects, which if you take a look at anybody who's bending metal objects now out there, any mentalist is actually doing it, it's derived usually from something that I put on my DVD series, which was called Psychokinetic Silverware, that's out there that teaches people how to do this. What was really interesting when I did that DVD is because it was very instinctive for me of just doing these things that I didn't really think about how or why I was doing it the way I did it. So when I had to teach it, I had to break down each one of those bends and go, okay, this is why I do this. This is why I do this. And then I would have to question myself, is that really why I was shaking it slightly or holding it in this position? Or am I just making an excuse up for something that I've always done that's been a habit? And I found there were a couple of those little things in there, but the majority of things were just instinctive for me. I'm a troubleshooter. You give me, it's when I worked with Chris Angel, we'd sit in the room and we'd have to come up with about 350 different tricks that we wanted to do in 2 weeks. And that was really, that's the hardest part is why, what do you want to do? Not how do you do it? Because the how is easy. Like if you give me something you want me to do, I can probably come up with multiple ways of doing it. And this is one of the problems with when people say, well, why don't you just teach the scientists how to do these things? I feel like I'm setting them up for failure if I do that, because I could teach them two or three methods, but for everything I do, I usually have about 7 or 8 different methods of being able to bend a key or bend a fork, right? Mm-hmm. So if I teach you one method and then somebody else comes along, does it a completely different way, but very convincing, you might be set up to go, I know the trick and they're not doing a trick. This person has to be real.
Because I know the paranormal one.
Exactly, right? Yeah. So much better to bring somebody like myself who understands the psychology. I know if somebody's looking in a certain direction or if they're holding something in a certain way, it kind of, the body language triggers to me, okay, this is a trick. What are they doing at that point? Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to teach that instinctiveness of knowing how to read somebody's body language when it comes to an effect or a trick. I can usually tell immediately if something's being done by a magnet, by the way that the properties and the way that it's acting. But a regular layperson, they have absolutely no idea.
Yeah.
That reminds me. So like one of the things that I think people run into when you become a skeptical investigator is that if you don't believe in stuff by default, you're considered to be dogmatically skeptical and a doubter and a denier. And so like there's oftentimes we see stuff and I know that's not real. Like, can I figure it out? Like if I take that position, the people who do believe in it are not going to be very happy with me because I've already started from a position of not believing. So do you like when you see tricks and you don't know how they're done, do you still feel like you're being a good skeptic when you go, I don't know how it's done, but I know that's got to be a trick. Like, how do you work through that?
I think there's no reason you can't say to yourself, I don't know. I don't have enough information. I don't know if it's real and I don't know if it's real.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that's sort of a good position to come from, to where you don't immediately make up a decision. You might go, well, there's something about this that doesn't feel right. There's something about it that doesn't look real. Let me investigate it and find out if I'm right. So, I think it's also, it's healthy not to believe in every single thing that comes your way. I mean, this is the problem. A lot of people say to me, they say, Banachek, you know, what does it hurt to believe in these things? You know, what does it hurt to have somebody, telling you that they can actually read your future from the palm of your hand, you know, or tell you everything about you? And I think what it does is it chips away at critical thinking to the point to where you start accepting things. So when we get into a situation like this pandemic that we're in, you're willing to believe anything and everything, or you go to the other extreme side where you go, okay, it's all a conspiracy theory. I'm just going to go out there and I don't care because I don't believe in any of this. You don't start thinking about any of these things from a critical point of view, because it's been so eroded from you that anything that goes along with your belief. And this is the other problem too. I have a show that I do called Telepathy. And it's basically, it starts out all about my life, right? Well, and it talks about, and I perform things as if I'm a genuine psychic, like as if I'm really, really real, the whole first half of the show. And to the point to where I end the first half doing something that I feel dirty and nasty, like really bad, because I'm talking to people's dead relatives. And I think it's disgusting. I think it's horrible. And I know I'm taking advantage of these people. And I know that I'm messing with them emotionally in that particular moment. I know that I'm doing this, right? But I need those people to have the same emotional feeling that they would have if they went to a genuine psychic. Because if I simply tell them this is not real straight up front, they're going to say, yeah, but I had this one time when I went to a psychic, and they're going off that emotional response, that emotional feeling they have. But if I can create that in my own show, now when we come back from the second half, I can start telling them this stuff is BS. Why can I say this? And I can also apologize to them in that second half for messing with them emotionally. But I need to do this. I need to get them to have that exact same feeling. And there's a reason I told you this, and I don't know why. It had something to do with your question. What was that question? Alzheimer's is setting in.
Chatting in general.
Okay. Yeah, well, it was.
You don't. Great. Yes, you don't even remember.
Well, it was to do with the.
That's great.
How do you approach these sort of problems when you know it's not real, but you can't be sure how it was done?
Yeah, that's where we were. And I think it's a thing of. Really, that's almost the position you should come from, not just accepting things at face value, like anything, right? Okay, so you're a religious person. That's fine, but don't accept any person that comes along and gives you some sort of spiel from a religious point of view, right?
Yeah.
Because he may be a scam artist like Peter Popoff. They may be trying to take advantage of you. Because here's the thing. That's why I went into the show. Because at the end of the show, I said, look, I'm not trying to tell you what you believe. Believe whatever you want to believe, so long as you're not hurting anybody else. But keep in mind that for every belief that you have, there is somebody out there, a wolf in sheep's clothing, who is willing to take advantage of your belief. And they're going to take advantage of you. So it's that whole thing of like Randy, I think it was Randy, I can't remember who said it originally, but saying, you know, look, I have an open mind, but don't have such an open mind that your brain falls out, right? And I think it is that thing. Is like you've got to be careful of that. But on the extreme side as well, you've got to be where you don't have such a closed mind that nothing else can get in.
Yeah.
Right. So absolutely.
Yeah. Any information you're coming from, especially in this day and age, I think you need to be skeptical of. Like you just need to automatically be skeptical and be a critical thinker and do your own research and not just things that go along with the way you want it to be, but look at the things that go from the opposite side too. And it's a sad thing too, because if I'm talking to somebody and let's say I'm talking to somebody who believes in mediums, right? It's a sad thing because if I don't give them anything in return, I'm just leaving a gaping hole there for them.
Right.
So for me, it's much better for me to give them enough information so they can start doing their own research and make up their own mind rather than come in and get in a huge argument with them and tell them they're stupid, they're idiots and blah, 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 because they're not stupid and they're not idiots. Yeah. You know, we need to be a little compassionate about these things.
Yeah. And you just got me thinking, because I've been paying attention for the past few years. I've been working on other projects. But John Edward, I don't think he's got a TV show at the moment. And Sylvia Brown has now passed. And I'm just wondering, are there any TV shows out there at the moment?
Can I say the word bitch? I just did.
Sure.
So. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have to beep it out?
Yeah.
No.
I think she died when she died on purpose, because I literally was doing a show with Chris Angel and I had just written a whole bit about Sylvia Brown and she went and died the next day. So it was totally irrelevant.
There's one way to stop her.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but you've still got a lot of psychics out there like Tyler Henry. I did a piece for Vice TV not too long ago and it ended up being like edited in such a strange way that I felt like there was no real ending to the piece. I felt like maybe something else, another piece they had had dropped out or they couldn't use it for legal reasons. So they said, oh, we need your piece, and they put it in there. But one of the interesting things I saw, they had me look at a video of Tyler Henry, and he has this folder that he scribbles in. And he always scribbles in it when he's upstage, and it's always accurate information. But then he closes the folder and he walks up front and he does a lot of cold reading. Yeah. And the moment he starts missing on the cold reading, he steps back up on stage, opens up his folder and goes back through it. I believe that he actually has information written in that pad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like it. Or it's automatic writing.
Yeah. Well, that's what he's trying to say it is, but I don't believe that. Yeah. Because he's so accurate with the automatic writing, but with the cold reading part, he's not. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that,
wow.
So that's an interesting point. So you're a mentalist, and there's so much around mentalism for being able to do things. Well, there's lots of different ways it's done. I'm not here to like unmask it, and I'm not qualified even if I wanted to. But but there is stuff like billet reading and a few other things that are like common to spiritualism and that sort of thing. And it's like one of those things that now that I'm aware of it, I have to say, well, wait a minute. How did this even become a method? Like it clearly started as a trick and became in part of a bigger movement. Like it's being used in different ways, these mechanisms. And it's just surprising to me because the fact that what is effectively stage magic is being used in ways that are deceptive in I'm going to say in a dishonest way. If stage magic is honest, because everybody knows it's a trick, then these are being done in a dishonest way because they're being presented as absolutely real paranormal effects.
Yeah, but you'll be amazed at how many mediums created a lot of this that magicians use. I mean, magicians borrow a lot from mediums and items they came up with. Some of the things that I've created and invented have come as a result of reading stuff about psychics and what they supposedly were able to do. So it's not always the opposite way.
Yeah. So it's bidirectional. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
And can you talk a little bit about how magicians share information? Because I know that there's ways that they, and I say share, it's usually for sale, right? I mean, it's like when you're like giving information.
It really depends. You know, when I started out, there was, you could get books and you could, you know, if you knew where to go, you could get these things. But it was kept more secretive than it is now. So much is out there. You can just type anything into YouTube. You can actually find it. It's one of the things that I tell a lot. You know, I used to get so much crap in the early days, a lot from mentalists, because I was one of the first ones that really came straight out with a very hard disclaimer saying, look, I'm not real. I'm not a psychic. And there were a few mentalists that said, there's no place for a fake mentalist. And I'm like, well, wait, no, mentalists by very definition are fake. It's what we do. Otherwise we would call ourselves psychics. Why would we have a whole separate name? Every magazine that we have as a mentalist is dedicated to doing tricks. You know, it's like the methods are there for us. We're not sitting here saying that we're real to each other, because that would be real, right? So they would get really upset. And then I came in really with, I'm not the first one to do the whole psychology angle, taking my five known senses to create the illusion of a sixth sense. And they always come back and they say, oh, there's more than five senses. Yeah, but you know what we're saying. We're just playing semantics when we get to that point, right? Mm-hmm. And Ned Rutledge, who was a mentalist, came up with that term, taking that quote, take your five five known senses to create the illusion of a sixth sense. And Randy introduced me to that. And I called Ned up and said, look, I'd love to take this and run with it and use it in my books and try to get a whole new direction for mentalists to go. You know, where we're using verbal, nonverbal communication, magic, don't get rid of the word magic because we're definitely using lots of magic, perceptual, non-perceptual manipulation, but we're using all these things to create a show. I have effects in my show that rely solely on psychology, but I have backups that use tricks to get me out in case of psychology doesn't work. And I'm using psychology all the way through my show to make the trick effects work even better. Like this choice is a better outcome than say this choice. Either choice will work, but this one's going to be more impressive than that one. So if I got five objects and I need one pick, where am I going to put it? I'm either going to put it on the second place or I'm going to put it in the third position because there's more chance of it actually getting selected, right? So I do use a lot of psychology in my show. But the problem becomes when you get too far into that, a lie becomes a lie becomes a lie, right? So saying you're psychic is a wrong and it's a lie. But if you start saying everything you do is NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, or just pure psychology, once again, you align to your audiences. And I think as a mentalist, you leave yourself up fairly to be exposed, right? Because you're no longer saying it's a trick. You're not being honest. So a newspaperman has the right to come along and expose your trickery. But the bad part about that is if they expose your trickery, they're exposing the trickery of the good guys, the good mentalists, right? The guys that are like magicians. When you go see a magician, you have an understanding that you're seeing a trick. It's the context of it, right? A lot of mentalists will say to me, they say, well, Banachek, you know, if you were doing a play, you wouldn't stop in the middle of the play and say, hey, I'm not really Macbeth. And I'm like, yeah, because it's the context. And they use this and they believe this is sound logic, right? And I'm like, no, you know, that people come, they know it's a play. When you go see a magician like David Copperfield or somebody like that doing stuff, it's the lines have now been blurred a little bit. But normally when you go see a magician, you understood they were going to fool you. You went in, you were entertained. You didn't really try to figure out the tricks necessarily, right? Mm-hmm. But when they come see a mentalist, most people have never seen a mentalist before, although it's becoming more and more common, but they still don't quite understand what it is. If I have a group of people coming that believe and are true believers, they're going to believe no matter how much I tell them it's not real. Doesn't matter what I say, even if I show them how a trick's done, they're not going to believe. I'm going to have a group of people that aren't going to believe, skeptics that aren't going to believe no matter what I say. But there's a large group of people in the middle who've never seen a mentalist before. And those are the ones that I have a real responsibility to. I don't want to change their beliefs because I'm there to entertain them. I'm not there to lecture them. So it's my job to remind them that, hey, this is a trick, that, hey, this is not real. Hey, I am not a psychic. And I think that's really, really important for me to do with my audiences. I don't think it's fair when a skeptic comes to a mentalist show and the mentalist is saying, hey, I'm not a real psychic, and then they start exposing the tricks. Or they go off and write an article about this mentalist that they saw and they expose the tricks. Or a magician, they expose the tricks. Because I feel like it's kind of like, it's not cool. It's just not cool for it because you're ruining it for those other people that want to go see the show. When you went to go see it, you were amazed so much that you wanted to look it up and try to figure out the methods. Maybe you went online, bought a couple of Banachek's books, right? And read them. Now you know how the secret's done and you want to tell everybody how the secret's done. Why? Why can't you just tell them, hey, he says he's not real. He's not a real psychic. He's not.
And they could be wrong too.
But you are actually.
I have had people give explanations for my tricks and they've been completely wrong because they do know a method like we talked about before and they assume that's the method that I am using.
But you are really Hamlet though, right?
Okay, you know what? We agreed before we got on. We're not talking about this.
Gonna edit this bit out. But speaking about shows that purport to be true in context, ghost hunting. We talk about a lot about ghost hunting on this show, and there are a lot of ghost hunting shows that have been around for decades. Do you have any interesting behind the scenes information about how some of these shows operate and how the producers try to keep things exciting for audiences?
I was approached a couple of few different times by different networks to work on these shows behind the scenes. And the idea was less was better than more. So basically just a small little thing happening. And that's what they wanted me to create. However, I did not take them, but I do have some people that I know that have taken those and they're they become part of the crew and they make little things happen behind the scenes. So sometimes, quite often, even the investigators have no clue how that hairbrush fell off the table or what that little EVP sound was or why, you know, it's as simple as taking a walkie-talkie even, you know, you press the walkie-talkie, it's going to set the EVP readers off, you know, I mean, not the EVP, the, my brain just did that whole thing. The
EMF. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Yes.
K2.
I knew it was an E. I knew it was an E. Yes. Yeah.
It was definitely an E word. Definitely an E. Yeah.
Exactly. Thank you. Yeah. You're very good, John. Yeah. So just pressing your walkie talkie will set that off. You know, there's all these little tricks that we could use. Yeah.
I'm highly suspicious of any EMF stuff because everybody's carrying around phones. Like everybody's carrying around so much equipment.
I've got a great thing with a guy having the EMF. We did a thing with Chris Angel and it was like, I'd set up this place in Sweetwater, Amargosa Hotel. And I'd set up all this stuff to fool these investigators when they came along. And the moment they got off the bus and they were talking, I was like, I told my guys, I said, nope, we're not using any of that. We're just going to use pure psychology to get them. And that's exactly what we did. But I've got a great tape of where we're in the opera house. And they're holding a camera here. And they're taking the reader. And literally, it comes over by the camera. He's like, there's something right over here. You know, it's like, yeah, your camera is right there.
It is tragic to watch that unfold. It really is.
But there's certainly a lot of psychology to that with people feeling cold spots and I think that they really go into these things expecting something to happen.
What I did was, I'll give one thing away. I don't like to give real secrets away, but nobody will ever be able to use this. So there was one thing that we wanted to bring a bunch of celebrities and we had to walk through all these rooms and we had them feel what they felt was like, you know, do you feel a ghostly presence? Do you feel weirdness? Do you feel anxiety? Do you feel anything in any of these rooms? And all the celebrities felt the same in the same room, the exact same thing. What we had done was actually we just switched the number on the door around each time. So as they're coming out of the room, you see the number on the door, they're walking out of it, and all the doors look the same, right? But then when we did it with the people coming in, it was simply a simple, well, I mean, with the actual investigators, I'd say, now this room I really want you to pay attention to. And of course, just using those words alone, this room I really want you to pay attention to. Like one got sick, wanted to throw up, one got a headache. And it was just simple language that got them to go ahead. So that when we show the actual video to everybody later on, you know, the celebrities were impressed, you know, the paranormal investigators were impressed. And it was definite proof that something was going on in this one particular room. Yeah.
Now, are you? It is. Are you? A lot of magicians I know are like big nerds about historical magic. Are you that way? Do you like have like?
I don't want to say I don't hate magic. I love magic, but I get bored with magic sometimes because I know so much.
Yeah.
And my life is so much more than just magic. I have a few times sat in a room with people where we do a lot of card stuff, but I'm not that guy to sit there and do like 100 card tricks, right? Or watch 100 card tricks. After 2-3 card tricks, my brain is like, okay, that's enough card tricks for me right now, right? That was truly amazing, but I don't want to sit here. My life is so much more than that. You know, I have family, I have friends, you know, I want to get out in the world. I read books. I do, you know, I'm eclectic when it comes to my life. So it's not just one thing that I want to concentrate on when it comes to magic. I love magic history. I love more the stories that go along with the history of the different magicians, you know, how some of them are gun runners and just, you know, the things that they did back in the day. And I love all of that kind of stuff. But really the actual history of a specific effect, it just doesn't interest me that much. Although I think those people should definitely get credit for their creations.
So are you autodidactic? I mean, do you like just constantly try to educate yourself with whatever you can?
Anything and everything in life. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like all over the place, if that's what you're asking.
Well, I am because I know Randy is, and then so is Penn.
Yeah.
I don't know what Taylor's background is, but is that common among magicians or just the ones I like?
I don't know who you like, so it's hard for me to tell you. And who you don't like.
All those magicians.
Well, those three that I just mentioned. Yeah. Sorry.
I think the thing that we have in common, that group that you mentioned, is we thirst knowledge. We thirst knowledge about many different things, right? I'd rather know a lot about a lot of things, but I'd rather know a little about a lot of things than a lot about one thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good approach. So,
yeah.
And you mentioned Peter Popov way back at the start of the interview.
Yeah.
And you were involved in the expose that I guess everyone seems to have forgotten about today.
Yeah.
And he's come back in so many different iterations. Could you tell us a little bit about that original expose?
His son is now doing it. Like, they're raising his son to actually take over the ministry.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And you saw Jim Baker recently just got in trouble, right? Because he had the bottle of the water and said it would heal COVID. And he's in trouble all over again. So back in the 1980s, and I think it was around 1987, the Amazing Randy came to Houston, Texas, and he was writing an article on evangelist for, I don't know if it was Hustler magazine. It was one of those. It was either Hustler or Penthouse, one of them. And he said to me, hey, would you like to come along and see this evangelist with me? I'm like, yeah, I'd love to. So we showed up at one of the biggest auditoriums in Houston, Texas, probably about, 8,000 to 10,000 people. I don't know exactly. It was a while back, but 8,000 to 10,000 people, a lot of people there. We show up and, you see the regular preachers are there and everything and everybody's excited. And then Peter Popov hits the stage and this was the evangelist. And he comes out, he's like, Mary Jane, I'm just making names up now, but Mary Jane, you're back in section F2, it says, and you're wearing a yellow outfit. Where are you, Mary Jane? Stand up. Your doctor's Mr. Johnson, and he says that you have a lump on your breast, and it's cancerous. And he's giving him all this information, right? And he does this multiple times. And then he starts healing people of cancer. He starts healing, causing kids that can't walk to walk again, enable them to walk again. The blind can now see. And it's very emotional. I'm getting caught up and I'm having tears in my eyes, but I know it's all BS, but you just get caught up in the emotion of this.
Yeah.
And then there's a point when Popov wants to collect money. So he asks for volunteers to come down. I run down there and I get a bucket and I walk around the room. And I must have had about in cash $10,000 at least in my bucket. And keep in mind, there's like 15 buckets, right? And so I walk down and I have to walk outside to come back around. I'm looking at this bucket. I'm thinking, if I wasn't ethical, I could leave this building with this money right now and nobody would ever know. But I'm ethical. So I come back, I give the money to this unethical man. And then he gives me another bucket and to get sealed offerings. So now I've got to go around. People are writing checks and different things and putting things inside of envelopes. I give that. So God knows how much money, well, not God, but anyway, Popov knows how much money is in that bucket, right? And then he gives me a third bucket and I go around and now I've got to go collect anything else that people want to give. And they're giving watches, cufflinks, things like that, right? Any jewelry they're putting in this bucket. I come around, I give that to him. And as I hand it to him, I look up and I notice he has no ear hole. In other words, he's got something white inside there and it looks like plastic. So I come back to Randy and say, look, Randy, either this man of God can't heal himself and he's using a hearing aid, or something else is going on and somebody's like communicating with him. And Randy was like, no, I don't think so at first. And Randy thought he was using mnemonics. Now, I know I use mnemonics in my shows, right? Mm-hmm. So because I have a really bad memory anyway, so I need these little memory cues, things in my head that I use. And I'm like, no, I know something about mnemonics. Either you memorize a lot of things about a few people, or you memorize a few things about a lot of things. We don't memorize that much information about that many things. He said, are you sure? I said, I'm pretty sure. So then Randy ended up going to Peter Popov's next revival, which was in Upland, California. And he got a friend of ours who was an electronics expert. And our electronics expert friend checked all the frequencies that were in the area ahead of time, way ahead of time, cut all those out so we wouldn't have to look for those later on. And then started looking for new frequencies. And sure enough, the moment that Peter Popov hit the stage, a new frequency, the frequency of God, showed up. I think it was like 39.17 megahertz, but I could be way off on that because I'm dyslexic and numbers mess with my head. We ended up taking on the Tonight Show. And what you see originally is the edited version because they used to edit every single one of their shows for TV. You see the edited version that Popov showed on TV of Popov coming out, talking to the audience. But then they show that same edited version again, but they show it with the voice that we actually captured. And it turns out God is Peter Popoff's wife. And she was feeding him information. And some of the stuff we got was really, really horrific. You know, there were a lot of racial slurs, you know, joking with Peter about not touching the woman's breasts, you know, that has cancer in it as she's coming down the aisle because he'll be mad at her. And just a lot of disgusting, nasty things and them laughing about, you know, the people that they're supposedly healing. Took a while for Popoff to disappear, like at least a year for him to disappear at that point. Because at first he said, hey, we had hired an actress to imitate Peter Popoff's wife. And then when it was pretty obvious that it wasn't, you know, an actress, he said, well, so I thought everybody knew that, you know, sometimes I enhance the word of God by getting this information. And the way they got the information was multiple different ways, right? So one way, people fill out these little prayer cards and they put them in a box. So they would just switch out the prayer box and that would go outside. Another way was Mrs. Popoff would come out and people come to these things hours ahead of time to be healed. They leave the hospital on stretchers to come there, right? Which against their doctor's orders to come there to be near this man of God. And she would come out. She said, hi, Mrs. Popoff. I hope that my husband gets to you this evening. Where are you from? Who's your doctor? Well, okay, well, good talking to you. Then she'd go out, write that information, the best information down. And that was some of the information. So they called the cards, they did that. And then there's the old Catherine Coleman trick, which is the old wheelchair trick. And what this is basically they look for somebody with a cane that's not walking really well. And they say, you know what, we could put you in a wheelchair, put you right up front. You'd be near the man of God, Popoff himself. And, you know, maybe he'll get me. Who's going to say no to that, right, if you're a true believer? So you get put in the chair. And as he's walking along, one of, you know, Popoff's helpers is walking along, would say, hey, where are you from? What's your name? They'd get all the information that way. So when Popoff comes out on stage, he can look down at the person. He tells them their name. He says, I've never spoke to you before. We've never met before. Is that right? Absolutely true, because one of his other people did, right? He takes their cane, breaks it, throws it up on stage. Now, keep in mind, nobody ever questions, well, person can't walk. Why would they have a cane? And he would even say to them, you know, he says, your doctor says you'll never be able to walk again. And of course, they always say yes, because they're not going to question this man of God. They're going to figure he probably means never walk properly again. At this point, this person in the wheelchair has all this attention. They have all this, you know, the endorphins, the adrenaline's flowing through their body. You know, they're all excited. They're feeling better at this point, feeling less pain in that particular moment. And then we get to that moment where Popoff says, stand up. And the person stands up. And to everybody else, that's a miracle because this is the way they presented it, right? He says, take a few steps. The person takes a few steps. They could do that already. But keep in mind, they're also feeling all this energy in that moment. And then Popoff sits in the wheelchair and says, go to the back of the wheelchair and push me. Person goes back to the wheelchair. Now, basically, they have a walker. All they've got to do is keep up with the wheelchair. They push them. Popoff takes a wheelchair, puts it back where it was and says, now that's your chair, right? And they say, yes. To the audience, they think that's a person's wheelchair, but it's no different if you were at a movie theater with me and you come walk me, I go, that's your chair? You say yes.
Yeah.
You're not going to take that chair home with you, but it is where you're sitting, right?
Yeah.
So you're going to say yes. So the miracles happened. But like I said, it took about a year for Popoff to go off the air. He disappeared, but as you said, he's back bigger and better than ever. But he's really going after the Black community right now because the Black community is also a community that really doesn't know Peter Popoff. And keep in mind, this is now generations have gone by as a result. So, yeah.
Well, I think you highlight a really interesting point, too, when you were talking earlier about the kinds of things that Popoff was receiving from God, the kinds of messages that he had information about that person's doctor and the street that they lived in, lived on. The mediums of today don't seem to go into that much detail. They seem to be a lot more vague. They're not as specific. They talk about, oh, I'm getting an A name or a name beginning with an A and I'm getting someone who's died of cancer. And then they kind of whittle it down to one or two people in the audience. But it's just interesting to see those trends in the way that this
It's a smart way for them to go because you look at Popoff now, he says somebody out there has a headache, somebody out there has cancer, and he will have prayer cards and read off names or a few things. Maybe he just makes names up. Who knows? You know, looks for
that big.
There's a John Smith out there. Well, there's going to be a John Smith or a Bill Smith somewhere out there with something wrong, right? So if you look at his congregation when he does these things, usually now the video is in a much smaller room because all he's got to do is show a few miracles. That's all that he has to do to convince people through the television media that this is absolutely genuine when it's not, you know.
With believers in the audience,
yeah. Yeah, and probably Stooges in the audience as well. I wouldn't be surprised if he's not using a few Stooges. I have heard that, and I actually did an interview with somebody just recently, did some research. I have heard they're still scared that Randy's going to come do a second sting on them at some point. So they're very, you're not allowed. If you work in his ministry, you're not allowed while you're in there to have a cell phone. You can't have your cell phone, you know, all of these kind of different precautions. There was one girl that did have a cell phone at one point, and she had worked there for a while, and she went to the other room to text her mom or somebody that was sick and came back in, and they said, you know, you're not allowed to have cell phones in there. And basically they had cameras everywhere, and that's how they knew. Because she said, I was on my cell phone. And I said, you lied. But again, I don't think they would fire her in that moment because she has so much information about the ministry. So they want to keep people as close as they can in this day and age. Mediums is different too, right? I mean, you take a look at mediums. I mean, it's funny how so many of these things have all started really in scams when you take a look at them. I mean, you take a look at mediumship, right? It started with the Fox sisters, you know, and in the United States, down in, you know, Hydesville, which is no longer there. It's actually right outside. It's just now a suburb of Rochester, but it's called something completely different. And the old burnt down house is there, and they've encased it, you know.
I've been there. It's awesome. I mean, well,
yeah, right.
It's awesome. I don't know. Yeah,
it is bizarre the way they have it set up out there right now. Yeah, it's very, very bizarre. But you take a look at that, and you know, I mean, that all started with an apple on a string under the bed, you know, and then it metamorphs into their toes and wrap, you know, more wraps, you know, that way. And then they came out and exposed it, but it already, the cat was out of the bag. I mean,
they were the first rap stars.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, they were the first rap stars, indeed. And I'm going to use that line with your permission.
No, go for it.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. So, but it became, you know, I started, you know, I made it over to Europe, and then from there, we started needing physical manifestations to prove that the ghosts were there. So that's when we started getting to, you know, the spirit cabinet and going from there. And now we've gone all the way in the other direction where we don't even need any of those things right now.
We just
give out information. That's all we need to do. And I think it's sort of the smart way for them to go. And who's to say that just because something's on Facebook, that doesn't mean they got it from Facebook, right? It just means that, you know, the spirit might have communicated the same information. So that doesn't really expose you.
Oh, yeah. They're still going to be scrambling to believe.
Yeah.
So we're actually running up on the end of our interview here. And we've talked about really core stuff for our show about critical thinking and skepticism and how people can be deceived. But we haven't talked about monsters. We need to talk about monsters.
We're talking about monsters in a loose sense. I mean, certainly Peter Popov is a monster.
Definitely. So is John Edwards. So is Tyler. So is, the Long Island Medium. They're all monsters.
Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have any monsters you like?
Well, I didn't prime him for this question.
No. So this is like very, very impromptu. So
I don't think I do have a favorite monster. I mean, I like them all.
When you were in South Africa, sort of like
I was in South Africa. Yeah,
did they have any local? Yeah, I'm just not trying to step on you, Karen. Go ahead.
I'm trying to think of when I was a kid if there was anything like, you know, when I was a kid, because I was so young then, it was the same monster that was everywhere. It was the boogeyman under your bed. You know, those were my monsters boogeyman. As a kid. Yeah.
We talked about your monster.
I don't even know the history of the boogeyman. I mean, what is the history?
We don't know for sure. We don't know for sure, but we do know that. It probably is closely correlated with the development of the bed.
Yeah.
It has to be under there. So
why the name? Does it got to do with boogers or?
Oh, you know, okay. I'm being silly, but, it actually.
Me too, but I mean, I don't.
It goes back to Booger Man, and there's like
is that somebody from the bog, maybe? Like a creature that lived in the bog?
No, I think if I remember, please don't hold me to this, listeners, but I think it was like related to like Bogart, like the same, the spirit, the European spirit of the Bogart.
Oh, not Humphrey Bogart.
No, not Humphrey. Right? No. This would be like basically a general purpose unknown monster that can pop out and get you. Yeah. I mean, I joke about it because like I always think it's under the monster under the bed and like there's the monster in the closet. I think they're probably related. They're close species, but I don't think they're, you know, so we don't really know. You know, it's the fear of the unknown, and that goes back as long as we're aware of like there is an unknown, and we might be killed by it. So, you know,
if I had a favorite, I don't think I ever did. You know, I'll tell you, listeners, one thing, and they're just going to make fun of me, but I always think No, I always think back to these things. You know, here's the thing, right? And I think this is why the word skeptic got such a bad connotation. We started going more and more with critical thinking, right? Because people misunderstood what skeptic was. And I think it's because so many people, they forget that they had beliefs. They forget that when they were a kid, they were scared of certain things. They forget that they became educated in such a way that they were ignorant of what they now know. There was a time they were ignorant of this information that they had. And then when they, some people just want people, and it goes back to that whole thing of like exposing tricks for no reason at all, right? Just to show how smart you are. And it really doesn't show how smart you are. It just kind of shows a little bit of a meanness about you when it comes to that. But I always try to remember that when I was a kid, I remember laying in bed. And I truly like go back at this in my head, and I don't know what it was. I don't know whether it was because my mom and my stepdad were always fighting and it was my way of release. But I remember little guys on my windowsill. Yep, little guys this big with wheelbarrows doing cartwheels and doing all this stuff. And in my mind, I actually saw these guys, like, and they were putting on a little show for me. Now, I say that now and you go, oh, man, if I said that now, you go, I was crazy, right? But I think it was my way of, you know, of stepping away from everything else that was going on in my life. Now, I told my mom, and she did take me to the doctor. I did get a shot. I'm sure the shot had nothing to do with that. It was probably just a vaccine or something like that, right? It was something. Yeah. But she said it was to make them go away. And I never did see them again after that. I also remember laying in bed, and above the doorway, there was a glass. And I remember seeing shadows and ghosts up there. And it was everything, like I was sweating. It was everything in my body to get up out of bed, run at that same door because it was the only way to get out that room, open the door, run underneath them and go into my parents' room. So I remember those things. And I just try to remind myself, there was a time that I believed in these kind of things. There was a time when I sat there with that little needle trying to get it and believe that it actually bent, right? So I'm not going to think somebody else is stupid just because they have beliefs in things that I don't believe or things that seem so obvious to me. What I am going to do is try to give them some information if they want that information, or if I feel that what they're believing in can actually hurt them, right? But I'm not going to try to teach them in a stupid way, and I'm not going to try to make them feel like idiots about it either.
And I think that's a really humbling thought. And my son's going to turn 5 in a week, and right now he has a lot of imaginary friends, and he's worried about this invisible sickness outside. And so he's just coming up with a lot of things, I think, that are comforting to him.
Yeah.
And I think it's really great to be able to remember those things from childhood. But I certainly agree with what you're saying about skeptics. And I think just to add to that list too, I think some skeptics can not be aware of their blind spots. I mean, that's exactly what a blind spot is. It's something you're not aware of. But a lot of people aren't terribly self-effacing and don't really look inwardly and see the areas where they have blind spots and hypocrisy.
There are times people give me a story and they say, what do you think? You know, was it real? And I'll usually be fairly honest and say, I don't have enough information. I won't immediately say, no, it's not real. I don't believe it. I think blah, blah, blah. I just say, look, you know, there's not enough information for me to actually know. I know you believe it, that it was genuine. And who knows, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. You know, I just don't have enough information from you to tell you what I think that might be. And maybe to them, that's a thing of saying like it's real because that's how they're going to take it. Well, maybe they'll take it. Oh, yeah, maybe I don't have enough information either. I need to investigate it. Maybe they're going off that emotional response. You know, Penn Jillette, it was at one of the TANs, the amazing meetings. I think it was an amazing meeting. And Penn was up there. And I'm going to paraphrase this because I don't know the exact words. Okay, so forgive me, anybody that was there. It's the idea that it is, right? It doesn't have to be necessarily specific. But I think somebody said to Penn, they said, Penn, you know, you have kids now. What are you going to do someday when your kid comes home and tells you that he believes in Jesus and believes in God? Are you going to tell him he's an effing idiot like you do other people? You know, are you going to yell and scream at him like you do other people? I'm sure they didn't say that, but that's basically what they were saying, right? And Penn stopped, and to his credit, he said, wow. He didn't say yes. He didn't say no. He just said, wow, I'll have to think about that. I've never really thought about this before. And I thought that was huge in that moment for Penn to realize, because now it becomes personal, right? And then years later, I heard Penn say something again, paraphrasing. He said, you know, I've always thought, you know, when people come up to me and say they're going to pray for me, I'm like, who the hell are you to pray for me? Like, I don't want you to pray for me. And he said, and then one day, and I guess he had been sick or something, and he said, one day somebody said that to him, and he realized, wow, this person actually cares for me. They care enough to take time out of their life to pray for me. Even though I don't believe in their God, I don't believe in any God, I don't believe in it, they actually care for me, maybe more so than some of my atheist friends. You know, they're taking time to actually genuinely think about me and care for me. How can I fault that? I can fault their belief, but I can't fault the fact that they care for me. So, and it was nice to hear that.
It is. He's mellowed a lot. He seems like, and I think what you said earlier is completely on brand for us, which is skepticism with a lot of compassion and empathy, because we've all been in places where we didn't know what was going on. We were scared, and there were things that, and Karen and I, a lot of this show has been about things that scared us when we were younger and like what's really going on there. And when we uncover the truth, you lose the mystery, but you learn more about the world, and you know, it just reminds
empowering.
You. That, yeah, it's absolutely empowering. So
I have a podcast. I just did one on hearts, and I touched upon that exactly, that there was, when you start looking, and it's called Banachek's Brain. If anybody wants to look, sorry for the plug, guys.
No, please. I was actually.
No, please.
But Banachek's Brain, and it's on hearts, and it talks about how the human heart works. And in that, in the description and the details, and I'm going into the electronics of the heart, I'm going to all these different areas. And it's like, there are so many amazing things in this world. And this is just something that's inside us, like one little thing that I'm talking about, that we don't really need to believe in the pseudoscience stuff that's out there. Oh. You know, these are tangible things that are truly, truly amazing and truly wonderful. And if we were going to say anything was a miracle, it would be those things, right? And why don't we look at those things? Why don't we, you know, learn about those things? Because this is things you can actually grasp. This is knowledge that we know. And there's so much about us that we don't know yet, inside us and outside us, that we don't have to go after all the pseudoscience. We don't have to go after the boogeyman. We don't have to go after life after death, the mediums and things that we can't prove. We certainly have disproved many times. That's possible. But yeah, we have at times. Yeah.
Well, that sounds really cool. So Banachek's Brain, is that available on iTunes?
It is available on iTunes, other aggregators. Also, if you forget, you can go to www.banachek'sbrain.com. I prefer you don't download it there, because it's a lot harder to keep track of everything, and leave a review too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and will you be touring with your show as soon as you can again?
I have cruise ships that are booked, which seems weird. I've had a few that have canceled. I've got to say, Royal Caribbean was great on the first one they canceled. They paid me for it anyway.
So
nice. It was nice, right? The next two they canceled, I did not get paid for, but that's okay because I didn't do them. But I got some in the fall. I don't know what's going to happen with entertainment. There's so many performers here in Vegas that basically they don't know what's going to happen. We have absolutely no clue. They don't know if they have jobs to go back to. Everybody's been fired. Like everybody pretty much has been fired, which is good and a bad thing, because they were able to go for unemployment and things like that. But coming back, it's like, we don't really know. Is it going to be like you sit a person in a theater, one in every three seats? And if you do that, can you now make money? Because you've got to sell a certain amount of seats to break even.
Right.
So it's going to be, I think the smaller shows are going to come back first. They'll all come back. But the bigger shows, it's going to take a little while before they come back. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, the world's changing.
It sure is. I mean, I had some casinos that were booked. They say that they're postponed, but I don't have a date that they're postponed to. So we'll see.
Well, good luck. I mean,
yeah, good luck.
Thank you.
Stay safe.
And I'm going to be fine. It's my friends that I'm really worried about. So
I think we all we all have friends who are in peril right now, and so I'm sure some of our listeners are having their own challenges. And we appreciate everybody trying to stay together and do their best in all this, and I hope we're all okay on the other side of it.
Yeah, Karen, when you get done with your book, I want you on my podcast, please.
I would love to appear on your show.
Absolutely.
That'd be great.
Yeah,
and if you need any pun consulting, you can call me.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for your time. It was really great to see you and chat with you, and I think our viewers have really enjoyed this.
Yeah,
it was a lot of fun. And it was great to talk to you again. And you can support us on patreon.com/monstertalk and check out our show. And we'll be back next week.
Who will we be back next week with?
What's going on?
Not me.
we'll figure that out. All right. Thanks a lot. Have a good night.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to a podcast version of Monster Talk Live, a special feature that we recorded during 2020.
Links to the video version of these episodes are in the show notes. Please like and subscribe to our YouTube channel, and we'll work to continue to provide good content there, including more streaming events in the future. Monster Talk is a listener-supported program, and your subscription at patreon.com/monstertalk sustains us during these difficult times. Thank you for your support and for your positive reviews. I'm Blake Smith, and along with my co-host Karen Stolzno, we ask you to join us in being the voice of reason and science in a world that's perilous with nonsense, superstition, and dangerous misinformation. Shine your lights, everyone. Even a flickering candle can be seen for miles in the darkness. And together, we are stronger. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thank you so much for listening.